Hey friends, this is Scott. I want you to know how much I appreciate you as listeners, and I hope you appreciate my sponsors because they make this show possible. Raygun provides full-stack error, crash, and performance monitoring for tech teams. Whether you're a software engineer looking to diagnose and resolve issues with greater speed and accuracy, or a product manager drowning in bug reports, or maybe you're just concerned you're losing customers to poor quality online experiences, Raygun can provide you with the answers. Get full-stack error and performance monitoring in one place. The next time you're struggling to replicate errors and performance issues in your code base, think Raygun. Head over to raygun.com, that's R-A-Y-G-U-N.com, and get up and running within minutes and dramatically improve your online experiences of your users. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Nick Steenhout from incl.ca and the Accessibility Rules podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm doing pretty good, Scott. Yourself?
I'm lovely, and thanks for chatting with me today. You are a speaker and a trainer and a consultant on web accessibility and disability, and you're actually a Francophone as well, bilingual. Do you podcast in both English and French?
No, I started podcasting in English, but I'm actually preparing a couple episodes in French for ready for the Bastille Day, 14th of July, coming up in a couple months.
All right. You're up in Canada?
Yeah, Montreal.
All right, cool. So one of the things that I wanted to talk with you today about is I noticed in April, end of April, that the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, WCAG, is that a proposed recommendation. I knew that there was a Content Accessibility Guidelines 2 that was, I want to say, 2008. Did we just go from 2 to 2.1 and it took 10 years to do it?
That's right. It took 10 years to get there, and it took quite a long time to go from 1 to 2 as well, but things are pretty much on the ball now, so we're going to see a more rapid iteration in as much that the W3C does not do anything quickly because they're standards and it's important to get it right. But we're moving ahead with 2.1. I have it on good authority that is going to be a proposed recommendation in June, so as of next month.
That's good. Not to put too fine a point on it, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say that it's a lot has happened in 10 years. Why is this not 3.0?
Because they're working on silver, which is actually going away from the denomination of Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. It's actually going to be called just the Accessibility Guidelines. So the code name is silver since Accessibility Guidelines is AG, which is on the periodic table reflecting the name of silver. So they needed to get something in between to be able to address some of the issues in 2.0 that aren't addressed around cognitive disabilities, around low vision issues, and a few other things that we had realized as experts that weren't working quite as expected in 2.0.
I see. Okay, so let me see if I can paraphrase it if I understand this. So 2.1 is a revision or a refinement of 2.0, which was well thought of and been around for a while. So even though it's 10 years, it's a good thing that we're kind of tightening the screws on WCAG 2.0. And then the element for silver is AG, so then that would explain why it's codenamed silver. And then that's going to be the next generation, the future of web accessibility.
That's correct. It's important to understand that the upcoming 2.1 are not actually eliminating everything in 2.0. It's kind of an add-on. So There's a series of success criteria that are going to be added to the guidelines, but they're not superseding what was there in the past. So it's extending and improving what's already there.
Mm-hmm. Who are these guidelines for? Are they for me and the listener who are web developers, or are they for the browser makers?
The short answer is yes. They're for everybody out there. The browser makers need to understand what's happening out there because they may need to understand how to implement some of the things under the hood, but that's not really primarily the main thing. I think it's mostly about the developers and the business owners out there that want to make their site or web-based apps accessible for people with disabilities. It's really kind of like a blueprint of things that we need to do to make sure that the site works for everyone, regardless of technology, assistive technology, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And there was a word or a phrase that you put in there just a moment ago, success criteria. That's a very important phrase. It's kind of the thing that informs the entire working group.
Yeah. The web content accessibility guidelines are broken down into different elements. First, there's four principles. Those are: elements must be perceivable, operable, understandable, and robust. Based on those four principles, then we have 12 guidelines. And each guidelines is broken down into a success criteria. So we may have things, for example, success criteria 1.1.1 is non-text content. That's basically the success criteria that explains that if you have an image, we have to have alternate information about it for screen reader users, basically. Of course, if there's information about the image for screen reader users, suddenly there's information for search engine crawlers. Mm-hmm. Because an image is not normally going to give very much information to Google or Bing or other search engines. So these success criteria are there to help us understand what we need to do to make a page or an app accessible.
Okay. And then this breaks down these four principles of accessibility into like a little bit more detail. So for example, the first one, perceivable, it says it can't be invisible to all of the senses. The user has to have some way to get that information.
That's right.
Now, most people, I would say most kind of, what is the term if someone is not disabled or not differently abled? We don't say normal, regular, typical. What is the right phrase?
In the disability community, we often jokingly say instead of able-bodied, we'll say they're temporarily able-bodied, because at some point in our lives, we all acquire some form of disability, whether it's a temporary impairment, a situational impairment, or a permanent one. But I think that people without disabilities, able-bodied people, I think these classifications ultimately are not particularly useful, because we obviously, the concept of accessibility is to help people with disabilities, but these things help everyone. It really comes down to usability. For example, there's a success criteria in WCAG that is about color contrast. So you have to make sure that the text has enough contrast against this background. And if I'm going to the specific for small text, which is smaller than 18 point, the color contrast ratio must be 4.5:1. So it's got to have a fair amount of contrast. So if you're thinking gray text on gray background, it's not going to meet that success criteria from an accessibility perspective. But if you go out and look at the site that has gray text on gray background on your phone and you're in full sun, chances are you're not going to be able to see and make sense of what's on the page anyway. So we're looking at tying things that help people with disabilities that also help everybody else.
You know, that is a really, like, if anyone gets a message out of this podcast, in my opinion, I think it would be that this isn't about web developers who are listening to the show thinking, here's some extra markup that I put on my website so 1% of my users that aren't me can use my website. It's really, here's a set of best practices that are going to make the web available to everyone, better for people who are typically abled, and much better for people who are differently abled. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair to say. There's all kinds of examples like that. You know, one of the things that we recommend is use plain English when you write on your site, assuming your site is in English, right? So plain language. And that's really good for people that have maybe cognitive impairments or learning disability like dyslexia. But it's also really good for translation engines like, you know, Google Translate. It's also very good for people that have maybe a situational impairment. Let's say you're a mother of a young baby, it's 4 a.m., your baby is not doing too well, and you're juggling, on the one hand, the baby in your left arm, and you're trying to look up information on your phone on the right arm. If things are written clearly and succinctly, you're going to be able to get the information much easier. So there's, you know, there's all kinds of information of concepts like that that were primarily for people with disabilities and kind of carry over into a wider audience usability.
Yeah, I noticed that there's a bunch of really great features on my iPhone where for you that you can allows you to use the iPhone with one hand. I don't typically use it with one hand, but again, you have groceries in one hand, and then you are situationally differently abled, and suddenly you're going to want to be able to use those features. And I just use them without thinking. I don't think of them as accessibility features, and that's really useful.
Yeah. Incidentally, while we're talking about accessibility feature on the iPhone, and that applies to other platforms, Android as well, and a lot of these technology that we're using now without even really thinking about it actually started as assistive technology. So, you know, one of the primary example I gave in my talk about the evolution of assistive technology is the keyboard. You know, the keyboard as we know it is pretty much the evolution from a Hanson Ball typewriter that started in the 1800s, where director of a school for the deaf wanted his deaf students to be able to write and interact with people as fast as people were talking. And from there, it evolved. So we're using today a product that was initially conceived for people with disabilities. If we're talking about Siri, the assistant, is also an evolution of that. There's all kinds of things that we use in pretty much every day that started their life as product designed for people with disabilities. And lo and behold, it's actually really useful for everyone.
Yeah, and in fact, if you take the Siris and the Cortanas and the Alexas of the world, they are often faster and more convenient. I'm still trying to convince my spouse that talking to Siri to search the web is faster than using her thumbs. So sometimes we have, you know, search races to see who can find the information quicker, and usually asking a digital assistant is a better way than just tapping it out.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that, you know, these products that came into everyday use for us are suddenly going through that circle again of being even more useful for people with different disabilities. There was a bunch of noise happening a few weeks ago, maybe even a month ago, about how people who are blind really are appreciating the ability to use Alexa for all kinds of things. So it's this circle, you know, something comes for people with disabilities, it goes into wide use for everyday use, and then there's refinements on that, and it helps people with disabilities even more.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've been really happy about is there are people who like closed captioning, and there are people who need closed captioning. I don't know if it's because I'm getting older, but my wife and I always watch television with the captioning on. Mm. Somehow I make it, I don't know, it simultaneously makes my hearing better and worse, but I never miss a word because I've got the words on.
Yeah.
Of course, now I can't watch a show without the captioning because I feel like I'm missing something. But I've noticed that the rise of Twitter is that all videos have captioning at the bottom, and that, you know, you have like those news videos that you can watch a video with audio muted in line, like at the DMV or something. I really enjoy that. I think that's a benefit for everybody.
Yeah, and it's also useful. You know, captioning is useful if you're trying to find out information about something or other. You find a tutorial on YouTube, you're in a cubicle in a large room with mm-hmm. dozens of people. You don't want everybody to listen in as to what you're doing. You don't want to disturb their ability to work or get on calls. So suddenly captions are very helpful there as well.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons that this podcast has partnered with a company called Greta, GRETTA.com. So we have captioning and transcripts for all the episodes of Hansel Minutes. And I've also got captioning on my other podcast, Azure Friday. And that works great, not just for people who with a hearing disability, but with people who are learning English. They can read and listen along.
Yes. I've been pushing so hard for everybody that I know that podcasts provide transcripts because it makes a big difference for, as you say, people that are not necessarily native English speakers. If someone is looking for information, it's often faster for them to read a transcript faster than they can sit through a half hour show. It's also a question of making things accessible for people that aren't able to listen to the show. But there was a case study done by NPR when they decided to put their transcript on every single show for This American Life. Mm-hmm. They saw a whole bunch of benefits. Suddenly they had more search engine results. They had more people coming to the show. They had more people download the show. And they realized they had an indexed transcript of every single show they had, so they could find information quite easily about what was on the show 5 years ago or 7 years ago.
Absolutely. Hey, folks, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsors and remind you that when you support them, you're supporting Hansel Minutes because they make this show possible. Innovative developers help improve the lives of millions of small businesses and accountants that use QuickBooks worldwide. Your app could make the difference that helps them work smarter and put more money in their pocket. Enter Intuit Developer. From tech tools to growing your customer base to helping you get funding, Intuit Developer helps your app go from concept to company. Find out more at intuit.me/code. That's intuit.me/code. It seems like there's also a use for AI here. If you were mentioned before at the very beginning, thinking about images, right now on Twitter, if I tweet an image, right underneath the image, there's a click that says add description. So it's basically making the alt tag a very natural thing to type. But, barring typing that myself manually, I think that either now or in the future, we'll be able to have AIs that can say, yeah, this is a picture of a red lunchbox sitting on a table. And that can be described even if a human didn't do it.
AI is the future of many accessibility features. On YouTube right now, they have auto caption, and it's not 100% accurate. In fact, it might be 85% accurate. And if you're missing that one crucial word in 10, it can be aggravating. But things are getting better. Facebook has already started in implementing auto captions for photos. And again, it's not perfect, but it's a lot better than it was a few years ago. And the more things go, the more data AI is going to have to be able to parse this information and make it more usable for people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. So I definitely think AI is going to have a huge part to play in accessibility in the future.
Now, you are physically disabled. You're in a wheelchair. Does that affect your browsing?
No, it has no direct effect on my browsing as a wheelchair user. I do have a bit of arthritis in my hands, so that can sometimes impact my ability to use a mouse. And 2 years ago, I was very silly and I ended up breaking both my wrists. So instead of being able to type 80 words per minute, I was stuck with a very uncomfortable type with two fingers kind of situation. So I ended up having to use assistive technology like Drag and Dictate to interact with my computer. So that was interesting because as a wheelchair user, I had one view of accessibility, but suddenly becoming more or differently disabled in another range, I had to readapt myself to interacting with my technology.
That must have been like emotionally a very strange feeling because you have one disability, you feel like you're as empathetic as one could be, you understand disability, you're dealing with ramps all day, then you break your wrists, and then you're like, oh crap, is this what it's like for people with quote-unquote with a disability? Like, that is it affecting their day-to-day work in such a fundamental way? Like, suddenly my brain can't get the information into the computer as fast as before. Was that a shock to the system?
It was not a shock in that way. The shock for me was really this discovery that the assistive technology, you really have to learn, and there's learning curves. And, you know, for example, I was using Dragon Dictate, which is a really powerful piece of software that works best on Windows in English. I am a Mac user, so I was trying to use it on the Mac, and that was complicated. And I could not use the French version of it on a Mac at all, because that's just really not friendly. So basically, I discovered that the best piece of assistive technology forced me into using a different platform altogether if I wanted to be performant. So there's this realization that, for example, someone who's blind who may have been using JAWS, the screen reader called JAWS, for 15 years may not have an option to actually switch to a different browser or a different platform, because their assistive technology works best, is optimized best for a certain browser on a certain platform.
Yeah, you had mentioned that there is combinations that are, they're not official, but they are kind of like the de facto combination of this browser on this platform and this language is going to give someone with a certain disability the most success. And if they change one piece of that, they're going to bump into issues all the time.
Yeah,
that is frustrating. I'm looking at this list of success criteria, the ones that are new to the WCAG.
Yep.
Orientation is an interesting one, because I realized that 10 years ago, we weren't necessarily thinking about, you know, portrait versus landscape.
Yeah. Do you know why orientation is so important?
I think for me, it's when I'm in bed, I want Netflix to be one way and I've got my head the other way, but I honestly don't know.
Yeah. A lot of people that have mobility impairments, whether they're quadriplegic or have cerebral palsy or something like that, will actually mount their device, whether it's a phone or an iPad, on their wheelchair. And they can't actually change the orientation of their device easily. So if your site is coded that it's only going to work on portrait or only going to work in landscape, suddenly these people may not have the ability to actually use your interface.
That, see, and this is the thing about accessibility, I think, that people who do not have any major disabilities need to think about, is you might not be able to even consider, like, why would that matter? And then once you learn, you're like, oh, of course. Like, it's every one of these success criteria, every one of these accessibility things, once you get it, you immediately go, oh, of course, absolutely, this is important, this is important.
That's right.
Yeah, that's amazing. So these success criteria, there's a bunch of them. There's like, you know, a dozen and a half that are being added. Many of them are, like we said, refinements, but also new things where orientation came up. And then also like motion actuation is another interesting one. There are, I have applications on my iPhone that require you to shake the phone.
Yeah. Like
that seems to be a new thing. Shake the phone for feedback. Not everybody can do that.
That's
right. Additionally, someone else might be shaking all the time because of their disability. Yeah. So are they sending feedback constantly? They're not. So you need to be able to think about that when you go and just throw in a feature like shake for feedback.
Yeah.
That's a tough one. So these success criteria, you said, are for both the browser manufacturers and for the developers. Is there a tool that I can run? Is there one tool that I can run on, like, for example, my podcast site that's going to tell me that I'm okay, or will I never be 100%, you know, accessible?
The first thing to realize is that accessibility is not a checklist, and that while we have all these success criteria, it's very unlikely that all of them will apply to your site or your app. Mm. The other thing is that while there are accessibility testing tools out there that run somewhat automatically, they're not going to catch every problem out there. And some of these tools will even say, hey, actually, you have to manually review these items. So with that caveat, there's two tools that I think developers can really use and rely on. One is called the AXE accessibility plugin. It's AXE. It's by DQ, D-E-Q-U-E. E, and it's available as a plugin for Chrome or Firefox, and it's through the inspector tools, and it will actually scan your page and pick up potential accessibility issues. The other one is more of an API-driven system, which is commercial. It's called Tenon.io, T-E-N-O-N.io. And that's a really powerful tool that will do the same thing. It's going to scan your entire site if you want to have the entire site scanned, and it's going to give potential issues. These automated testing tools at the moment are only testing against WCAG 2.0 because it's not quite yet a guideline that is ready for prime time, the 2.1. However, that said, if you're coding, you really want to future-proof your site and your application, so you should look at using 2.1. So, yeah, automated tools are great to get a feel for what's going on a page or a site, to get a pulse as to what's happening and to get an idea, but there's nothing that's going to beat manual assessment by someone who's actually used to do that. And then the ultimate is to actually do user testing with people who are actually people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've been doing web accessibility for 23 years now. And when I do an audit, invariably, there's always one person that uses the web in a way that I didn't expect, or will, because of their combination of assistive technology, will find stuff that isn't quite what I expected. So user testing with real people with disabilities is definitely something you should do at the end of the process.
How far can we take it, though? We want to include everyone, but, you know, as they say on the internet, long tail is long. You can hit 80%, 90%, 99%. Everyone has different abilities. We talked about all the different abilities and disabilities that we haven't thought about. That one, you know, it's not my disability until it's, you know, it is. If I bring in blind people for testing, deaf people for testing, etc., will I ever be finished? You said it's not a checklist, but when do I know when to stop?
Yeah, there's always edge cases. And one of the things that I've heard over and over the last 2 decades of doing accessibility is, but Nick, I can't code for the person who's deaf, blind, and paralyzed from neck down. And of course, that's, you know, a rare situation. What I tell people is code to the standard. Make sure that things are meeting WCAG level AA as much as possible, and throw in as many success criteria from level AAA as you can, and you're going to be doing good. And then if you have someone who comes to you and say, hey, I can't use your site because XYZ, then you can look at how you can implement that. But bottom line is you want to put in maybe 20% of your effort to get 80% of the way to accessibility, get those low-hanging fruits that are actually typically fairly easy to meet if you follow the guidelines, and you'll be in a good spot.
That's a good point. It's also worth pointing out that it needs to be more than just a casual Googling for accessibility checker, running or pushing a button that says check it. Like, I just went to a random place and I typed in hanselminutes.com and it says no known problems. Okay.
Yeah.
I could go and say I'm good. But then I also went and looked at the AXE tool that you pointed me to, and it gave me 41 violations with 86 needs review. Yeah. And then I went to Tenon, which is a different tool by a different company, and it said there were 4 issues. So here's 3 different tools that I've used. One says 4, one says nearly 86, but 41 are definite violations, and one said none. So depending on who you ask, I either have no work to do or weeks of work to do. So I need to put some thought into that.
Yeah, I think it's a fair assumption that if you have a tool that says you have no accessibility issue, you can completely forget that tool, because unless you have done a lot of work to make sure that there are no accessibility issues, there will be issues. But, you know, comparing AXE to Tenon, they have different rules. They check for different things at different levels of being strict. So you have to do a bit of a balancing act. But, you know, if you have questions, go on Twitter and use the hashtag A11Y and ask away, or there's an accessibility Slack channel that you can use where people are very happy to share knowledge. So when in doubt, ask the experts.
Mm-hmm. So accessibility is often abbreviated as the, not an acronym, but a numeronym,
yep.
A11Y, where the number 11 is the number of letters omitted. And that is also the one of the titles of your podcast. It's A11YRules.com. You've been doing this for a while now with conversations around web accessibility with a lot of different guests, both abled and disabled.
Yes, it's been fantastic. I wondered, you know, I've been doing accessibility for so long and met so many people, and suddenly I realized I don't know these people. I don't know what they really think. We share technical tidbits and all that, but I want to get to know these people better. And then I thought, well, surely I'm not the only one in the community that wants to do that. So I thought, let's do a podcast. And suddenly it's been really interesting because I speak to a wide range of people and I pretty much ask the same base questions. And from there, the conversations really expands into weird and wonderful and fantastic areas where I'm getting to think about my own area of expertise differently. And I've had something like 23, 24 guests so far. I always ask, how do you define accessibility? And out of 23 guests, 24 guests, I've had 24 different answers. It all revolves around the same thing, but everybody has a little bit of a closer definition or something that they really care about that they want to involve in that. So it's really kind of fascinating. Just briefly, I have also an offshoot of that, the Accessibility Rules Soundbites, where I do short segments, 5 to 10 minutes with people with disabilities, where mm-hmm. I ask them, you know, what's your impairment? What's your barrier? And what do you want designers and developers to know? So that's a good way to hear it in their own words as to why these things are important.
That is actually a very clever way to make a 30 or 40 minute long podcast also accessible to people who maybe don't want to have the time or the patience. You can go to A11YRules.com. Right at the top there, click on Soundbites. You get 5 minutes on, you know, how does ADHD affect a web person? How does a screen reader work? What is speech recognition or color blindness? That's a very clever way to make your podcast even more accessible.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
We're going to have links to all the different things we talked about, like Tenon.io and Axe and on, as well as JAWS and the very important WCAG 2.1 rules, as well as links to Nick's podcast, the A11Y Rules podcast. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.